once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. In this episode, you will hear Jake say...
Interesting.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. And the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name... See if I can get my tang untangled.
It's not only a name?
It's not only the name of this radio show program. It is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm regulated by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which neither approves nor disapproves, but regulates.
Yes.
That is located in Salado, Texas, and does business pretty much around the country. And the fact that it's a registered investment advisory firm means that that firm gives investment advice, and the principals there, Jake and Jeff, give investment advice. Except
it happen
this,
to be the same two Jake and Jeff that are sitting.
No,
in
this
here.
Is Jeff and Jake, so it's slightly, it's our alter egos, which
alter
means
egos.
Older.
Yeah, we don't give investment advice on the air.
Right, we don't give investment advice on the air. We give education on the air, which is a different animal altogether, and we can get into great detail on that if you want to. But if not, that's okay. And the information that we provide here is not warranted or guaranteed to be completely correct, although we do get it from places that pretty darn good at giving out correct information, and if they screw something up, going in and acknowledging it and publishing the difference. Let's see, what else? Telephone number in here.
Mm-hmm.
It's 254. Got this. Just area code 254-773-1400 if you'd like to join with us. Presuming that this is the 23rd of February 2019 where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. That's 773-1400, and it looks like we're getting a call on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. There was an article in the Wall Street that Kraft yesterday wrote down $15 billion of goodwill, and their stock tanked 27%.
Actually, it's Kraft Heinz. You got it. You have to say it correctly. It's Kraft Heinz.
Kraft Heinz.
Kraft Heinz.
Yes.
Anyway, can you explain how a company can write down that much money? And I don't know. It seems like fuzzy math to me. I'll hang up and listen.
Oh, you just gave the perfect definition of goodwill.
But it didn't. It wasn't just goodwill. It wasn't just goodwill. There was actually some accounting issues going back for more than a year where they were paying more money for the stuff that they make stuff out of. You like getting highly technical here. The stuff they make stuff out of. And they had to come forward and confess that they really had higher expenses and lower earnings last year than they were acknowledging. And they said, whoops, sorry, too bad. We kind of covered it up. We hoped that we could make up the difference, and we couldn't. And we were kind of hiding the fact that our profit margins dropped. And no foul, okay?
The other part of it is that they wrote down $15 billion of goodwill.
Right.
So this is where the fuzzy math comes in. It's real. Fuzzy math is real, folks. Everybody that thought 1 plus 1 equals 2, well, you're going to have to – calm yourself for a moment, because in the world of valuations of companies, when they do their balance sheets, they do an estimate of what they believe the value of a name is. For instance, the Heinz mustard bottle. What's that worth? What is the name of Heinz and the logo? And when somebody goes to the store, and just to give you an example, there's a bias called overchoice. What that is anybody who's ever gone to the store to buy, here's a good one, toothpaste. You go to the store to buy toothpaste, and you don't know which toothpaste you're going to get when you show up. And you get to the toothpaste aisle. It's not just a section. There's an aisle full of toothpaste. And a lot of it's by the same brands. But they all have different packaging. Some of it has sparkly blue, and others have red, white, and blue, and others have just white, and others are blue. And you look at the ingredients, and They're the same ingredients across all of these toothpaste, but there must be something different, or why would they be in all these different packages? You can spend hours.
I have.
Looking at toothpaste.
I have.
That is a bias called overchoice. When you have too many choices available to you, it's hard to make a decision, which is where the value of a brand that you already know and use comes in.
You know what I did after spending a great deal of time looking at all the trying to buy a tube of toothpaste?
Just decide that you could get dentures?
No, I just reached out in the middle of all those. I knew I wanted the brand I wanted, but the brand I wanted had so many choices.
Right.
So I just kind of reached out in the middle and grabbed one and walked away.
Right. So the concept of goodwill, that is a value placed on consumers that know your logo, know your brand, and that's what they reach for when they get to, for back, lack of something else to say, the toothpaste aisle. In this case, it would be more like the ketchup aisle or the mac and cheese aisle or the mustard aisle. You grab the one that you're used to grabbing. What is that worth? And how stable is it? Well, the reason why they wrote down their goodwill is because over the 5 years since the major shift at Kraft Heinz, people have stopped using their logo, their brand, as much as they did before. They're not reaching for the same thing because of cost-cutting maneuvers inside, recipe changes, lots of little things happen. Just think back to what is the value of Coca-Cola. Berkshire Hathaway likes Coca-Cola. Berkshire Hathaway also likes Kraft Heinz. But what happened when New Coke came out? The sales of Coke fell through the floor. And so that's the thing.
Well, there's a company called 3G.
Yeah.
That took over Kraft Heinz as well as some other companies. And
it's a Brazilian private equity firm.
They arranged for Kraft and Heinz to merge. And they've been running the companies ever since. And the issue is that they can take these old line, very, very famous companies with very solid brand names, very well trusted, and they can cut dramatically, cut employees, cut costs, cut. And every year it raises the profit margin without raising the volume. Well, then they noticed something in 2017. The volume was starting to fall off because people were no longer crazy about ketchup. They were buying all kinds of alternative things to ketchup, and they were buying exotic forms of mustard. And
there's a generational shift happening now, where just ask Anheuser-Busch about that with craft beers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say craft beers are a big one.
Right. It has a very major effect on the bottom line. Anheuser-Busch just started buying up craft beer brands all over the place. They just bought up a lot of craft beers.
And they've done a wonderful job of ruining them, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. And that's basically what's happened in this big merger is a lot of recipe shifts. So people wanted the thing that they were used to, and if they couldn't have the thing that they were used to, they opened up the book and said, what can I have instead? And it didn't happen to be Kraft Heinz.
And anyway, as they went into this thing, as the sales started to fall off, Kraft Heinz put $300 million worth of marketing, which is like 3 years budgeted marketing, into this program. By the way, let me back up. 3G is famous for doing zero-based budgeting. In other words, each year, each person in each department can't start with last year's budget and
you got to start from zero.
You have to start and justify every cost all the way up. This severe cost cutting has destroyed more than it. Well, it basically is what destroyed Sears. You can't innovate. You can't move forward. And all of a sudden, last year, 3G said whoops and dumped $300 million. 3G said whoops and dumped $300 million into marketing. And said that will increase our sales dramatically, so we'll put that on the book. That, you know, and then they realized it didn't increase the sales dramatically.
Right. In fact, this is the thing: 2019's projected earnings for Kraft Heinz are exactly what they were, very, very close to exactly what they were in 2014.
Mm-hmm. And the issue is, of course, that.
That just says that the merging of these two things for cost-cutting measures, so lowering supply chain stuff, they didn't do it right. They messed up.
The issue of cost-cutting as a way to make more profit works for a short period of time. It's called, it basically kills the goose that lays the golden egg.
Right.
Ultimately.
You can have pate, though, for one meal.
and this is a pattern. That's, as I said, that's why Sears is in bankruptcy. Lambert just bought Sears, and said, we're going to, Sears is such a solid name, it'll be good forever.
Yeah.
We'll just cut costs and cut costs and cut employees and not upgrade our stores and not clean them quite as often.
And not get an online presence as quickly as all the competitors, because that's expensive. And yeah.
So there's a book I have called Corporate Lifecycle Strategies. And it basically says the barbarians to bureaucrats, that's corporate life cycle strategy.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book.
And the point is that barbarians create companies like Sears, which, by the way, was in its heyday, Sears was the equivalent of Amazon. It dominated everything. And then the bureaucrats eventually take over and the bean counters take over and say, let's cut costs. That's an unnecessary thing. This over thing over here is unnecessary. And they start cutting costs and cutting costs. And each year they cut costs, it raises profitability, but eventually the patient dies.
And this book, by the way, was written in 1990, well before the examples that we're using today. But this is well-known stuff when it comes to management. The whole thing about not feeding the milk cow, it'll keep milking for a while.
Well, actually, there's a biblical injunction against not allowing the ox that pulls the mill that grinds the wheat from eating to allow the ox to eat some of the wheat that it grinds.
Right.
And that's basically what it's all about. And you can do that in the economy, by the way, just as easily. You can do it almost anywhere. It's going on. I happen to have some people working that I know or that are inside the government doing things. And one of the things that's going on in the current administration is the president has called for a 15% across the board cut in expenses in all the government agencies.
But this is like sequestration, in that if it's not targeted, if you're not doing this with good management skills, you're just cutting good stuff with bad stuff. That doesn't make it better. There are bad things that need to be cut, but you got to focus on them. You have to figure out which ones they are.
So each department has this option of they have to cut, but they can't cut wages. So they wind up cutting. They can't cut quality because that's law. So they just order less stuff to fix things, and things gradually go broke. By the way, I went through this when I was in the Army. When under the antithesis of President Trump, a guy named Jimmy Carter, who did the same thing, by the way, who simply said, you need to cut your budget. But he didn't say where to cut the budget. He said less expenses. So what we wound up with is ordering fewer parts and having tanks and armored personnel carriers sitting in the motor pool that theoretically would run, but they wouldn't actually run. And this type of thing in corporate structure can be extremely damaging. It can be deadly. It looks really good in the short term when these takeover artists come in and say, obviously they're spending too much money. We can cut expenses by merging companies together and save lots and lots of money. And then when it doesn't work out, they go to the management of the company and said, save more money somehow. And then things start to deteriorate. And you probably have all seen that at one point or another somewhere in a business. And that's basically what's going on in Kraft Heinz. It is sad because what was he like? Sears not developing an internet presence. Yeah, Sears had a solid name and they had phenomenal goodwill associated with just the name Sears.
Yeah, if you this is.
It used to be Craftsman had a solid name.
Right. You said this a minute ago that Sears used to be the Amazon.
Right.
Sears started without brick and mortar. It was virtual. You ordered through the telegraph off of this really cool
catalog. Which this also served in the outhouse as a secondary purpose.
Right. It was a very nice cleanliness purpose.
Right. Recycling.
So you have this virtual company that over the years started developing brick and mortar businesses because people wanted to directly go to them. They didn't want to have to wait for the delivery. Amazon happens to be doing that at the moment. I don't know if you know about this.
Yes.
They are contemplating putting out stores throughout the United States. So it's following, again, the same life cycle of a company. It starts out virtual. You are a very low overhead. Then the name builds enough recognition that people say, I'm going to go to that store specifically because I know all this stuff that they have. And then more and more is spent on the overhead. The more and more glitz and glamour on the look of the building. and the profit margins drop until eventually somebody comes along and buys them and just tries to milk them for everything that they're worth, and it slowly deteriorates. Just ask Woolworth, Sears.
Oh, it's happening in other places in other ways, too. For example, this week we get in segueing into current news.
Right.
Honda announced it's going to shut down a major automobile assembly plant in the United Kingdom. And it's going to put roughly 25,000 people out of work in a town that desperately needs jobs. And there's a lot of howling and screaming going on, and Honda's
What town doesn't need jobs?
Well, there's towns like Austin where they have
They
more,
need jobs. If you took all their jobs away, would still say they desperately need a job.
But there's Swinton.
They don't have enough jobs there.
Swinton used to have a lot of heavy manufacturing, and it all shut down, and they had high unemployment. And then Honda came in and is their cornerstone in this medium-sized city in the United Kingdom. And Honda announced that in 2021 they're shutting down the entire factory and going away. And they're,
For good reason. They can't sell that stuff to the rest of Europe anymore.
They're bouncing around and say, oh, well, you know, this and this and this. But the bottom line to it is the fact that the United Kingdom has decided to go, if I could use a paraphrase, England first, and go and break away from the rest of the world and go England first has ramifications. It makes it more expensive to bring things in and bring things out of the country. And Honda looks at that and says it doesn't work. And we say, well, that's too bad about United Kingdom. We have in the United States, for example, between 300,000 and 400,000 people employed by Japanese and European automakers in the United States.
All right.
If we, for example, throw a 25% tariff, which is currently under consideration by the president, against Japanese automakers, you'd say, oh, well, these plants in the United States are obviously going to do much better. Well, no, because a lot of the parts to these automaker plants in the United States are imported from Europe or they're imported from Canada. And those would also be subject to the 25% tariff.
This is important to know. I mean, I have a Ford Flex. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot. It has lots of room inside it. It's very usable. It's a usable vehicle. Nice American car built in a Canadian assembly plant.
Yeah, and the point is, any time that you set out to do something to make yourself better at the expense of someone else, like severely cutting costs by merging companies together that each have their own brand name and think that nobody will notice and the quality won't go down and everything will be cool because all of those employees need to be gotten rid of anyway, it's generally a signal that the company is headed downhill and you might want to consider going someplace else if you're an investor. The same thing, unfortunately, occurs historically in nations when they decide that they're going to do some of the things that we're experimenting with this year. Now, is there any guarantee we'll always be that way? No, it could be that for the first time something will work. This is a grand experiment we're in the middle of right now. However, I just read three articles that reported on papers that very carefully looked at the economics and concluded that if we slap a 25% tariff on European vehicles and a 25% tariff on the Chinese imports, we could probably expect a recession in the United States in 2019, which seemed to carry a lot of weight. You'd think, well, if we slap a tariff on something coming from China and we slap a big tariff on stuff coming from Europe, we'll just make more of it in the United States. That would be fine if we had the factories, if we had employees that the factories could hire, if we had all the other stuff that is necessary to make the car in the United States. There's probably, if we had high unemployment, there might be some truth in that. But in this particular case, what it does is it hurts everybody's economy across the board. And this is not a political position. This is an economic position.
Yeah.
I don't care whether it's a Democrat or a Republican who suggests it's a good idea to restrict trade and put a big tax on trade. History has been very, very clear on that subject.
Yeah. Humans have been very, very clear on that subject. If you restrict trade, it becomes more expensive. It should not be a surprise when prices go up. Restrictions are harder to deal with. That's the most common sense approach that I can give it. This isn't anti-Republican, anti-Democrat, or pro either of them. This is stuff that before the last couple of years wasn't considered politics. It was considered established fact. And that's kind of a shock to both of us. That now, on the other end, if it's used as a negotiation tactic and it's clearly got deadlines associated with it that you can remove, that you can add, that puts pressure on a negotiation.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's some value to that. But the value is it's got a counterbalance, because you've got a negative value associated with the businesses that are trying to make decisions. If you keep that uncertainty out there for an extended period of time, it causes business slowdown. They're not going to open plants, they're much more likely to close plants. So as a negotiating tactic, using a tariff can be extremely effective, but it has to be a short threat with a very concrete set of you do this and this will happen, you do that and that will happen, rather than we're going to do this and at some point it may go away or it may not. And as an example of that, we have signed at the executive level the USMCA, which used to be NAFTA. It's been signed by three presidents of Mexico, Canada, and the United States. It still has to go to the legislative branches. It's going to have some uphill battles to fight in two of the three countries. Canada's probably going to be the easiest one to get through, but because it's already been negotiated so well for Canada. We still haven't gotten rid of the tariffs on Mexico and Canada. We've made the preliminary agreement. If it were a negotiating tactic, now would be the time to say, all right, good job, now let's remove these tariffs. But we haven't done it. And my thought on that is that the president has too many things on his plate. And his support team, this is, you may have followed this, the trade team, the people that are involved in the actual negotiations, have been swapped out three times in the 2.5 years that the president has been there, and they haven't had time to brief the next team on the strategy. That means that the only person in the administration that's really clear on the end game strategies that were started at the beginning, assuming that they exist, is the president, and the president has a lot on his plate. He keeps delegating, but then removing the people he's delegated to. So for good reason, most often, he's removing them for good reasons. But the end result is, who knows the reason for any of the negotiating tactics that are being used? And each team switches up the tactics. This is not how you do a good long-term real estate purchase, much less a big long-term deal with foreign nations. So it sounds like I'm talking negatively about the president. I'm not. I'm talking negatively about the entire environment that this trade war is existing in. We don't have clarity on anything.
And as a result, we're kind of wobbling right now.
Yeah, you can see it across the whole economy.
Stock market rose again this week. We're going to probably ought to get into that.
Yeah. Let's talk about what happened this week. We usually start the hour with that.
The S&P 500 was up 0.62%, which is not a lot, but it's up, and that's a wonderful plus. And it was fascinating to watch it during the week, because there was a lot of negative economic news came out. Manufacturing declined. The leading economic indicators are down. All things that normally would cause the stock market to sag. And each time we got a press release that said, okay, this harbinger of a future recession just popped up, the market would sag, and then within sometimes minutes and sometimes within hours, there would be a tweet or something released from the White House saying the Chinese-U.S. trade negotiations are progressing in some form or fashion. And the market would probably go back up and go up a little higher than it went down. The market would have been down for the week, except in the last few minutes on Friday, the president said that said something optimistic about the China-U.S. trade relationships. He said he was possibly going to extend the deadline, and if things were going well, and the market went up enough to get us a gain during the week. But there was a lot of bad news during the week for the economy, and this all could be transitory.
Yeah. One
of the problems we're running into right now, and it is a severe problem trying to figure out what's going on in the economy, is the data reports out of the Commerce Department, because of the shutdown, are coming out about a month late. So
because
we don't
shutdown
know.
Was about a month, yeah.
We don't have much idea what happened in January, despite the fact that we're well into February. The Commerce Department is just now releasing the data for December. For example, normally, about 3 weeks ago, we would have gotten the GDP, first estimate of GDP for 2018 and for the fourth quarter. We still haven't gotten that.
No.
So we're still guessing at how fast the economy was running, whether it was accelerating or decelerating. So we have the Federal Reserve of Atlanta saying the quarterly growth was probably going to be about 1.5%, and Moody's started out at 2 and then is gradually back down to 1.7 and still backing further down each time we turn around. So we're operating in kind of a fog right here, and it could be all the bad news we're getting was like the market in the fourth quarter that dropped like mad and has since almost completely recovered.
Right. And it could be that we've got a complete recovery in the economy. We don't know. And if you're a CFO and you're considering chief financial officer, and you're considering additional hiring or building a facility or expanding, you want to know that stuff. You want to know what's the general direction of the economy. This is part of your market research, especially if you're a large company. If you're a small company, you want to know what's the economy look like in the little town we're about to start a new branch. You don't want to start it if you don't think that it's going to be profitable, and that's where we are right now. We've got uncertainty stacked
on
uncertainty.
And we got a triple layer of uncertainty at least going right now. One, we don't know.
Uncertainty sandwich. Mm.
We don't know where the economy went or what was going on with any degree of certainty in the fourth quarter or in January because of the shutdown. And then you compound that with the potential of 25% tariffs on auto imports from Europe and auto parts, and 25% tariffs on everything that's imported from China is a possibility. And then you see why the orders look pretty good for factories, but the investments, the durable goods purchases by
long-term
companies
stuff, yeah,
that will cause their business to expand into the future is declining. It's not that its growth is slowing, which
is
what we've seen in the past.
It's actually receding. They're doing less of it than they did before.
And they're basically pulling in their horns and saying, we're not going to invest in the future. And that has an effect 6 months to a year out.
Cash is still there, and this is something – there's a lot of corporate debt. People talk about that. What they're not talking about is there's still a lot of corporate cash. That a lot of that earnings that came back as extra on the tax cut, they're still sitting on it, which is part of the reason why we're not seeing the projected growth with the tax cut on the corporate level, is because corporations are sitting on that waiting for some certainty as to where should we build our manufacturing facilities, where should we hire – because we don't want to make a decision that tomorrow is going to cost us billions of dollars when the whole situation changes.
The other thing is the respondents, when the Federal Reserve does its survey and the Commerce Department do the survey in business, are pretty much singing the same song they've been, which is, number one, there's political uncertainty going forward. Number two, we'd love to buy more equipment and build new factories, but we can't find people to fill the job slots that we've got. So there's a shortage of employable people that they can hire.
A shortage of shipping, which means even if they could hire the people at the extra price that the wages are now needing, we're seeing a job switch having an on average 7 point, I can't remember the exact number, so around 7% increase in wages by switching jobs right now, which means if you're hiring, it's not from a pool of people that aren't working anymore. You have to take it from somebody else, and that means that you've got to raise the price. Now you've got items that you're manufacturing in these facilities that you have to charge more for because you've got to pay these employees more. But you may not be able to ship them on the road because there's not enough trucks to do it.
To give you some idea about when we talk about business investment, The investment by businesses in durable equipment declined 0.7% in December. Now, that doesn't sound like much. If you look at this December versus last December, it's still up 2.5%, so that looks pretty good. The issue is if you go back to August and you look at the year-over-year increase in business investment, it was 13.6%.
And then we had the trade war.
And then the trade war really heated up, and we went to a potential 25% tariff from a 10% tariff, and businesses across the board started not investing in the future. And this has got a big lag. This is, you know, when the economy was down in 2009 and we were trying to, you know, it was starting to come up, we were singing the praises of the fact that business investment was rising fast. And what that means is that sometime a year or two from now, we'll start to see a return on that investment. We'll start, and then the hiring started. And we said, don't look for the economy to kick into gear just because a lot of hiring has started. And the reason in productivity fell, well, if you're hiring a bunch of new people, you got to train them. It takes a while. So there's a big lag. When business investment slows down to the degree that it is slowed down now and is slowing, and there seems momentum on the downside, again, we don't have all the data, so we can't really make a up-to-the-moment guess at this. That effect will hit us not this year, probably, but next year, when the investment you don't do this year is the income you don't get next year, which kind of leads into all the rest of the stuff. But speaking of leading into stuff,
we've got to play some commercials.
We do.
If you would like to call the program while we're off the air, and we'll bring you on the air when we come on the air, the phone number to call in here is
254-773-1400. That was sneaky.
I had to try to see if I could catch you.
You're trying to catch me napping over here.
We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here hasn't changed. It's still 254-773-1400.
We've got one piece. We talked about it in the break, and I wanted to bring it up because it's kind of cool. The Supreme Court ruled this week.
Unanimously?
Unanimous ruling by the Supreme Court. Do you know what that means?
It means pretty profound. The liberals and the conservatives and the ultra-conservatives and the ultra-liberals all agree on something.
Yes, so it means that we have common ground. And the thing that was agreed upon is a man was pulled over while driving. I guess that's how you get pulled over. He was found to have $380 worth of heroin on him. First off,
actually, it was in his trunk, but that's
yeah, it was in the vehicle.
Right.
First off, no bueno. Heroin's not good any way you look at it. It is nasty stuff. They arrested him, gave him a fine of $1,500, and seized the vehicle that he was in.
Which, by the way, he'd bought with an inheritance.
Yes. His mother's estate had given him $42,000. He had used it to buy a Range Rover or a Land Rover? It was a nice vehicle, a nice SUV. Well, the sheriff's department seized the vehicle and said you couldn't have it back. It was seized in the commission of a crime. Well, this was argued in front of the Supreme Court. States have never been limited on what amount they could seize in arrests, because up till now they've been pretty clear that they're not going to overseize. They're not going to take too much. Well, the Supreme Court said you took way too much. You cannot do that. You cannot seize more than the maximum fine.
And it's actually in the Bill of Rights. It's the Eighth Amendment in the Bill of Rights, that unreasonable fines. And the state, I think it was Minnesota, the state of Minnesota has a maximum fine for that amount of heroin of $10,000. It's either Wisconsin or Minnesota. I do get those mixed up. I apologize to anyone from there. And seizing a vehicle that's worth four times the maximum fine allowed by law was clearly an excessive fine. And the state's argument, I love the state's argument. First, they said the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to the states. Boy, that was a good one to argue.
Yeah, it actually, in the argument, all of the justices laughed when they said that.
And the other thing is, the Solicitor General from the state said, when asked the question by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Are you trying to say that if a person was going five...
Indiana.
Oh, it's Indiana. Okay. Well, I'm sorry. Boy, I really got the states mixed up.
Yeah, it was one or the other and neither of them.
Are you trying to say that if somebody was driving a very expensive car, let's say a Ferrari, and they were driving 5 miles over the speed limit, you could seize the entire vehicle because they committed a crime with the vehicle?
And the Attorney General
the Solicitor General of the state said yes?
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing that says we can't. And that, again, caused the justices all to laugh.
And
yes, there is. It's called the Constitution.
If you're ever arguing before the Supreme Court of the United States and your answer causes all the justices to laugh and you are serious about that answer...
It's probably not good for your case.
Yeah, you probably... I have this kind of funny... If they all laugh, you're in trouble. You're in serious trouble. It's stand-up comedy in front of the justices of the Supreme Court is not a good idea.
They are known for not... They're not known for laughter. Let's put it that way. They're not known for their sense of humor. And when they think what you said is funny, it's probably not good for you.
And I think this is – I'm not certainly in favor of people dealing or having heroin or cocaine or drugs. But the fact is
– What happens next time?
There have been a large number of houses – and Texas, by the way, is pretty good at this – at seizing an entire house.
Yeah.
Because – For example, there have been cases, I think it was in Houston, and I may be a little off here, but I know it's happened around the country, where the teenager had some marijuana in his room, and the local authorities seized and sold the entire house as a seizure because it was marijuana found in a teenager's room that the owners of the house didn't even know was there. There have been numerous boats seized under those circumstances.
And this is something that it doesn't cover. So if you're out in international waters and the Coast Guard stops your boat and you've got drugs on board, say goodbye to the boat. You're not in constitutionally protected area anymore. That is across the board. You have drugs on board and the boat doesn't belong to you anymore.
And it's a very interesting point about that enforcement law that was designed to stop drug trafficking. You don't have to be convicted of anything. That in some cases they've seized the property and then never brought charges against
Kansas
the person.
Kansas is famous for that. If you're carrying more than about $500 on your person in Kansas, they are likely to seize your cash, all of it. And you'll have to take them to court to get it back because they have suspicion that it might be used in a crime.
And this is an interesting point. I was listening to a commentary on it by a law professor. He said, the interesting point about this is there's no constitutional protection for the $500 or for the car or for the house because the seizure, it was a civil seizure, and it was not against the person. It was against the property, and property has no rights in the Constitution. People do. But the legal fiction that they were working with is this action was not taken against the person, it was taken against the property.
Yeah, so there's another Houston case here that is kind of big. It happened in December. Police were surveilling someone. He was in his car, and he was smoking something. And they didn't think it was cigarettes. It was wacky tobacco. He was smoking marijuana. So they came over and pulled him out of the car, and he had 13.5 grams of marijuana, which is a very low-level offense. This is a misdemeanor territory. They seized the car. He was never charged with a crime. They didn't give the car back. It wasn't his car. It was his mother's car, who had recently loaned it to him so that he could get his pregnant girlfriend to the hospital for complications. So now they have seized the car of a young man who obviously he's got a girlfriend that's pregnant and he's smoking pot in his mom's car. This does not sound like a responsible, upstanding citizen. But the seizure of a car when charges were not ultimately brought, that's a problem. I'm not trying to limit the police. We got to stop crime, but there are some real issues here. You can't fund your whole budget based on the teenager on the corner smoking pot. That's not what we do here.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I just called because I want to thank you for bringing this subject up.
I have a friend in Killeen that same thing happened to. The driver in his pickup had a half a marijuana cigarette, and the Killeen police seized his pickup, I think $5,000 cash, and his wife's wedding ring that was in the console of the pickup. They never filed charges on him, but they kept everything.
And that sounds amazingly like a police state, you know. And I am really, really pleased to see the Supreme Court weigh in on this. By the way, the Ohio State Supreme Court overruled the lower courts and said it's perfectly all right to seize as much as you want to.
Yeah, and now the Supreme Court of the United States, who basically cannot be overruled unless Congress passes an amendment to the Constitution and it's ratified by the states.
There's several states. Louisiana, there was an article in a Reader's Digest years ago about Louisiana seizing cash money, especially around Sulphur, Louisiana. They're notorious for that. So, but a fellow said many years ago, when authority is unquestioned, freedom is lost.
You know, you're completely right. Why don't you ever think about having a radio show?
Yeah, you should have a. I think we've got a spot just after our program that
you should probably get on.
You would fit in with the guy that hosts that so well.
Yeah, I'll try to remember that here in about an hour or two.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Con.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. And the telephone number remains 254-773-1400. Con's got it memorized.
Yeah, and
Con had a very good point there.
Yeah, I've got Con's got a subject he really likes when I talk about, so I'm gonna bring it up.
Okay.
I talk about automation, and I've mentioned in the past that automation causes skills to be lost. It really does. I mean, most people do not know how to do blacksmithing.
Or basket weaving.
Or basket weaving or pottery, though they exist, and it's coming back. There are now more blacksmiths in the United States than there were 15 years ago by a significant amount because there's a niche for it. People have YouTube, and they can learn how to do this, and people like it when they've got handmade stuff. So to some extent, some skills actually come back after automation. Here's the big one. One of the effects of the low immigration rate, low illegal and legal immigration rate, and I know that there's political weight associated with that. I have to look at the monetary numbers. Monetary numbers are the most realistic. Go and talk to farmers who have a history of hiring migrant workers. And what you will find is that the average pay for migrant workers, documented or undocumented, is at $17 an hour to work out in the field right now.
Hmm.
Just think about that for a second. It was only about 8 years ago that you were talking lower than minimum wage. So this is bringing in the robots. Strawberries are one of those areas where humans have just assumed it will never be automated, because how do you pick a strawberry without crushing it? How do you not squish or damage the strawberry?
You just get a smart robot.
And they have a very smart robot that lots of them that are being tested by lots of different companies. And right now, the highest success rate is about 50% of the strawberries are not being smashed. Do you know what the human equivalent of not smashing?
What is it?
70%. So last year,
they're getting close.
Last year, the robots were only saving 30%. Now it's 50%. That means just the same normal projection line. Next year, we won't need workers on those farms. It will be a robot. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
How are you gentlemen doing today?
Pretty fair.
Pretty good.
Pretty good. I just wanted to comment real quick. I was brought up back in the 80s and stuff like that, you know.
So you're a young man.
Everybody worked.
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, it was in Houston, Texas. And a phenomenal thing happened every morning on my way to work when I was 16. I had a big job. I was at an iron place. But anyway, every morning off of Jensen Drive, you would see two or three trucks pull up on Jensen Drive, and they'd have all the illegals jump in the back of the truck to go to work for the day.
Right.
Okay.
And were you sure there was those were all illegals, by the way?
There were a lot of illegals.
Actually, to be honest with you, there's no way I could tell you.
Okay.
that they were illegal. So I humbly apologize about that. Right. But
they were likely illegals. We can say that. Likely.
Yes.
Likely, yeah. Well, my point in that is, and keep in mind, I'm 16 working in an iron shop. I'm trying to help mom and daddy feed the family. And everything. It was hard times back then, you know. Anyway, they were making more a day than I was making. And the only reason I know this is because I was very frustrated, and I went and said, hey, maybe I should do this too, you know. And they told me how much you get paid for a day, cash, and I was like phenomenally just blown
away.
So
why weren't you jumping in the back of the truck?
Jumping in the back of the truck, exactly.
Did
why,
you?
Why weren't you?
Why didn't I?
Yeah.
It's because my father told me to put my nose to the grindstone, stay in my trade.
You get better at it.
Eventually, you'll get better at
that's
it.
That's right.
And you will make a whole lot more money.
Right. Yeah.
And I think, see, that's the whole thing right now with where we're at is, it, in my opinion, and I humbly say this, my opinion is that we don't have these generations coming up having to put the effort out, if that makes sense, or to do the hard things to get where you need to be.
I was accused of the same thing, by the way, when I was told the same thing when I was young, that this young generation doesn't have a work ethic. It's just not doing any good. They're used to having everything handed to them. They don't know what hard times are, and they just don't have that work ethic, and the whole thing is just going to go.
I think every new generation needs to earn their work ethic. And I think that's important. You had to earn your work ethic. I had to learn. It's not something you're just born with. You have to learn it. And
yes,
the new workers have the hardest time learning it. Eventually they learn it or they lose their jobs. And what we can look at with the unemployment numbers is that basically the vast, vast majority of people that want jobs have them already. And we still have all these openings for migrant labor. The problem with migrant labor is that the strawberry harvest only lasts less than a month. So you may be getting $17 an hour, but you got to make your money this month. And that's it. It's gone after that. Either that or you got to go on to the next harvest. But this is one of those things about a harvest is they tend to be seasonal. This is why they have migrant workers that are going north and south and trying to match as much of the harvest season as they can. The result of all of this is something we've been talking about for months and years, is automation.
I know you got to go to a break or whatever. I won't take much more of your time. But my point is, and I want listeners to hear, that I was a ninth grade dropout, and I worked through the system. I worked. And they saw white privilege. Well, white privilege was for me was to get out there and earn a living and hustle every day of my life. Whenever at a ninth grade dropout, by the time I got 30, I was well over $200,000 a year. And that I'm proud of.
Congratulations.
It's not congratulations. That's what a man does. That's what a person does. Excuse me, I'm not trying to be. I'm just saying that's what a person does is you get up, you pick yourself up, and you go.
And the recognition is in the money, but I also want to recognize you without money with that congratulations. You say it's what people do, but some people don't. I'm sorry, we have to break for hard yes, break, but I appreciate your effort. Thank
God
you.
God bless and take care.
All right.
Yes, sir.
We are about out of time for this hour. If you'd like to reach us off the air, we have a local voicemail.
254-947-1111.
And you can reach that number 1-800-914-PLAN or go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com.